Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Roderick's with you on this Election Day 2014, primary election day in Maryland. Thanks for tuning in. I'm glad you could join us. In this hour of the show, as voters head off to the polls, we think anyway, we're going to get some a report on the turnout from WYPR reporter Chris Connolly. And then later in the show, we're going to talk with Alan Friedman, an Annapolis attorney, former director of governmental relations for Anne Arundel County, who has served as an observer of elections in Eastern Europe six times now, most recently in Ukraine. So we'll get to Alan's insights from his experiences as an election observer in foreign countries. But we want to get Chris Connolly's observations on this one at hand here in Maryland. Chris, nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Chris Connolly, of course, a reporter with WYPR News. So you've been out and about this morning along with Karen Hostler of the WYPR staff.
I was out and about. Karen was out and about. We've had a bunch of our reporters out and about in here in Baltimore. We had people in Annapolis and Anne Arundel, in Montgomery and Howard County. I was down in Prince George's County. Everybody is saying it is just very slow out there. Mm-hmm. Slow, you know, steady trickle, but very, very slow.
So all the voting was done in early voting, or most of it? I guess we can't speculate on that now.
Well, we know about 4% of registered voters voted, which is a record high turnout for early voting. Mm-hmm. But again, it's only 4%, so it's not a huge number coming out then. And you know, and some indication that folks were coming out for early voting because they weren't planning on being here because they're on vacation. It's June, school just let out. You know, people aren't that engaged.
And I was telling someone this morning at the bus stop, June is 24th. This is the first time we've had a June primary. Marylanders are used to a primary in September and a general election a couple months later in November.
Yeah, I think some people just don't know it's there, but I think that there's just a high level of disengagement in this race, which is sort of surprising because you have contentious races on, you know, both the Republican and the Democratic side of the gubernatorial election. You have this really heated, you know, Democratic race for attorney general, mm-hmm. and you have pretty much every state office up for election right now. I mean, but people are pretty detached, I think.
What did you see out there, Chris? Where did you go this morning?
So I was down in Largo. I was there. Anthony Brown came. That's his district. He came out with his wife to cast his ballot. No surprise who he voted for. It was, you know, there was a lot of energy around him being there, mostly mm-hmm. from his campaign volunteers who were out there chanting and cheering.
But you didn't see a lot of voters.
But not a lot of voters. I mean, there was one other voter in there when he was in there taking his vote. I talked to a number of people. I stayed there for a couple hours afterwards and caught people on their way out. And, you know, most of them said I was the only person in there voting.
Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, of course, a Democratic candidate for governor. The other Democrats, Delegate Heather Mazier from Montgomery County, and also outgoing Attorney General Doug Gansler.
That's right. Yeah.
Anything new on the Gansler campaign?
Oh, yes.
Any observations on the Gansler campaign?
Well, there's been there's a little bit of a controversy, Election Day controversy, from a tiff between him and the teachers union, the MSEA, out in Montgomery. So the teachers union
endorse him, right?
They did not endorse him.
Okay.
What they do, the teachers union puts out, they call them apple ballots. They are in the shape of an apple. They are on bright red paper, and they have their list of endorsements. And out in Montgomery County, Doug Gansler's campaign also has a ballot that is in the shape of an apple that says teachers support Doug Gansler across Montgomery County. Now, the teachers union has sent him a letter that says basically cease and desist. They say the apple ballot is a registered trademark. Gansler's campaign says you can't trademark an apple. Right. So a little bit of
interesting. It's sort of classic election day effort there by a challenger of Anthony Brown, who does have the endorsement of the teachers union.
He does.
And a lot of other endorsements. Okay, so it's slow. We'll keep an eye on it all day. WYPR's news coverage tonight, right?
That's right. Tonight at 10 o'clock, we're going to have an hour of live coverage hosted by our own Tom Hall. And we're going to watch what's coming in as the results come in.
Okay. So you can tune right in here and find out the results, folks, on 88.1 WYPR. That's Chris Connolly from the WYPR News Department. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing. Happy to do it.
Tomorrow on Maryland Morning, of course, more results from the election and analysis. And we'll continue during the noon hour tomorrow, this hour tomorrow, with Barry Raskovar of PoliticalMaryland.com and Melissa Deckman political scientist at Washington College who joins us from time to time. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Open phone lines on midday today. We're going to be speaking with Alan Friedman when he gets back about his observations of elections in Eastern Europe. And we'd like to hear from you if you have any observations about this election, this campaign. 410-662-8780. Did you go out and vote today? Did you take advantage of early voting? Are you not voting? Are you a fed-up independent, wish that we had open primaries? Whatever you like to talk about, open phone lines in this hour, 410-662-8780. This is Midday. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to Midday Election Day. Dan Rodericks here, 410-662-8780, our Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Always looking for feedback and comment from our listeners. Alan Friedman is joining us now. He's an attorney based in and consultant based in Annapolis, who has quite a lot of experience in government. Most recently, he was director of governmental relations for Anne Arundel County. And before that, worked in the administration of Governor Robert Ehrlich. I knew Alan Friedman when he was a public defender for Anne Arundel County. Alan, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again.
And I was aware that you had been an observer of elections over the years and actually always wanted to talk to you about this. So today's a good day to do it. You most recently were in Ukraine observing that election. We'll talk about that in a minute and how you got into this whole thing of observing elections overseas. But I'm curious about your thoughts about the Maryland election, not the outcome so much, just as here it is June. You just heard Chris Connolly saying, no surprise, low turnout. This is sort of what was anticipated.
Well, when you see overseas, especially in some of these very difficult political situations in these former republics in the Soviet Union, people going out to vote, very, very old people, young people, the whole spectrum, just trying to exercise that right to vote. They take it very seriously. There was a 60% turnout in Ukraine where, you know, a large part of the country is under a gun, literally. And yet here we seem to be a little more blasé. It doesn't seem to affect us as much. One wonders why.
I always wonder why. I know because we're in the news media. We're focused on the politics all the time.
We're in the bubble. Yeah.
We're in the bubble, I guess. Yeah. It is a bubble. Most people would just tune it out. They're not excited by this particular election, or it's come too early? What do you think?
Well, of course, the change in the date was huge. You had school let out a week ago. You have 4th of July next week. And this is just a time when people are not focused on elections. But one wonders, is it a cynicism towards elected officials these days? Is it Maryland, particularly as a one-party state? Does that drive down a turnout? It's just so hard to say. People have different reasons.
It's not a presidential election.
It's not a presidential election year. I think my experience, you know, over the years is, especially what's happened in this country recently, the economic situation is just so devastated. So many people, and people are just kind of clawing back from that, trying to get almost even to where they were maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they're focused on
their household,
getting that job, getting the kid, hoping that he doesn't fall down and break a leg and have to, you know, go to the hospital or get them to soccer practice or football practice or baseball. And it seems like Americans are much more focused on their individual lives. And I think you put that together with sort of a cynicism about government, and I think you get what we see.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here for Midday if you'd like to join our conversation with Alan Friedman. Okay, so how did you get into observing elections overseas? When did this start?
Well, step one was I lived overseas. That's how it began.
You lived in the former Soviet
Union? I lived in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, not the Atlanta, Georgia. This is the Tbilisi, Georgia, which is
on the— You lived in
Tbilisi? Tbilisi, yes. It's between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, bordering Russia, actually we border with Chechnya, and then Turkey to the south and Azerbaijan. I had to find it on a map when I was first headed over there. It's not doesn't roll off your lips. When I was working there, they had two elections, a parliamentary election and a presidential election. And the United States Embassy organizes observers as part of the OSCE effort, Organization on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And so because we were working there, we signed up, or they asked us to sign up, and we started.
Let me just take a moment here. You just mentioned the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
Right.
I don't know how many folks have heard about the
Probably
OSCE.
Not many, yeah.
This is an organization that goes back to the Cold War.
Right.
It represents today 57 nations in matters of human rights. Free press is a big issue with that organization, and free elections.
Right. Human trafficking is
human trafficking.
Issue.
And they dispatch observers all over Europe. They even come to the United States sometimes.
Yes.
And a couple of years ago, I distinctly remember the state of Texas was none too happy about observers from the OSCE being there for their election.
Right. And I heard stories when you are in this group of people from member nations of OSCE who were in that delegation back in 2012 and commenting on their view of American election laws. The countries of the OSCE, almost all of them have national election laws. The elections are regulated nationally. We, of course, have 50 different sets of election law.
Right.
And that completely sort of freaked out a lot of people. Depending on what state they went, the rules could be completely different. And so it was a problem.
So were you recruited or did you volunteer for the first assignment?
Well, I volunteered. Basically, the embassy put out word, and not that you were expected, but it was part of the operation to participate and to observe. It's really important, especially in those days. This is back in 1999. To have international observers in these elections. A lot of these elections were still tinged with Soviet-style techniques, and the presence of international people in a polling place or during a vote count was deemed incredibly important, both by the United States government at the time and organizations like OSCE, as well as local non-governmental organizations of Georgians, when I began, who were interested in reform and moving the country away from the Soviet practices.
What are your observations about that first election that you saw there?
It was a little rough and tumble.
What was it? Yeah, I'm just curious. What year was it, Alan?
This is 1999.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is like 10 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
5 years from their civil war.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very, very difficult time. Electricity was hit or miss. The government was populated mostly by former Soviet people. There was a large young reform movement that really hadn't taken hold yet. It would ultimately play out with Mikhail Saakashvili becoming president after a while and having a Rose Revolution after an election in Georgia. So it was dark. It was in the wintertime. There was minimal electricity, and the practices were highly suspect, to say the least.
So as an observer, what were you allowed to do? What were you there for? I mean, really, what is the assignment of an observer?
It is, first and foremost, observe. You can't intervene. You can't say you're doing something wrong. You can't say this person I saw in the previous precinct already voted. You shouldn't let him vote. It's really to have a presence, to observe, and to report back to the OSCE operation. In Ukraine, in this last election, they had over 1,000 people spread out over the entire country. The idea is to get a real sort of national view of the election, not what may be happening in one precinct, and then to offer its recommendations and sort of the totality of the observations to the host country as well as to the world.
Can you remember any of the observations you made or reported from Georgia from your first election?
In those days, you had a lot of what they called family voting. The head of the household would come in. They'd give him 5 or 6 ballots. He'd sign the book for his wife and maybe a couple kids, maybe his mother and father that were living with him. And he would vote for the family. It is almost a cultural thing, not an election law violation, but he's the head of the house and he's responsible for the opinions of the household.
So if there are 8 eligible voters in the household?
He might get 8 ballots at the polling place.
Right. So you made an observation about that.
We would report that.
That might be something they want to reform, consider
exactly.
Changing.
Oftentimes you'd see a busload of people pull up. I mean, I used to sort of comment to some of my colleagues in these things. I mean, this kind of stuff used to happen in Chicago or New York or Baltimore in the old days. So
410-662-8780. Alan, while you're here talking about the elections you observed in Eastern Europe, we can take some calls about those. The election happening here in Maryland today, right?
Sure.
You're pretty cool with that.
Sure.
Alan Friedman, of course, has been around Maryland politics a long time as well. And Sam in Upper Fells Point called in with a comment. Sam, I want to keep you holding there. Go right ahead, please.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Now, I've just had probably over 30 pieces of mail from the delegates.
Oh, yeah.
Campaigning,
yeah.
And then countless people knocking on my door, and I work from home, so I see it all. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered, you know, if maybe part of the low voter turnout and part of the if there's like apathy because of election fatigue, because I almost didn't want to deal with it this morning, and I was the only person at my polling place when I got there. So
really,
you know,
what time did you get there, Sam?
Oh, I was there at 6:55.
Okay.
I was there a little early.
Okay. Probably would have been the first in line, just that there was no line behind you.
Right, right. There was nobody else there until, you know, a good 30 minutes later when I was walking my dog.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Thanks for calling, Sam. It's worth talking about here. And we can compare this to Eastern Europe. I got an email yesterday from Jerry in Reisterstown who said, have you thought about spending a few minutes of your show discussing how idiotic robocalls are? Are politicians that stupid and arrogant? Maybe that's a rhetorical question. What makes them think that aggravating voters will get them votes? I see robocalls as unthinking, unfeeling, and lazy. So I got robocalls, and like our colleague here, I got lots of direct mail. Lots of direct mail.
It's a penalty for frequent voting because the candidates, my experience here in the United States, the candidates have the voter list. They know how many times you voted in recent past. And if you're a frequent voter, you get hit with more mail because the chances are you're going to vote again. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a penalty that befalls those of us that regularly vote to get so much attention either by the robocalls or with the mailers.
When you've been overseas or in Eastern Europe to observe elections, have you been there in time to see electioneering, to see campaigning that goes on ahead of an election?
Yeah, we're usually in country about 4 or 5 days before the election. OSCE also maintains long-term observers that have been in country for about 4 to 6 to 8 weeks who are sent out to the regions and who meet regional candidates, meet with the regional elections people, attend election rallies, and their observations are part of the final OSCE report on the run-up to the election. Was there violence at election rallies? Were campaign offices destroyed? What's the sense out in the regions of how this election is being conducted? Also, they monitor the local media, and they report on whether the media is showing bias or favoritism towards one candidate or another. In Eastern Europe, you have sort of a phenomena of having media, particularly television stations, owned by oftentimes presidential candidates. Petro Poroshenko, who was successful
in Ukraine.
In Ukraine.
And he makes chocolate and he owns the media too?
He owns one of the most popular television channels in Ukraine. OSCE reported that that channel spent about 60% of its election reporting on Mr. Poroshenko's activities.
Right. So it'd be like Rupert Murdoch running in the United States, maybe something like that.
And all of these countries have state channels. Mm-hmm. They are trying to transition those state, basically government channels, into public radio and public television, so that they're sort of more neutral and more balanced in their approach. But most of them now are still very government oriented, and OSCE monitors the pre-election coverage of the state channel to determine is the government that's in power using that sort of to wedge or to promote candidates. And what I saw once, I was in Russia in 2011 for the Duma election. And the day before the election, we go out and we kind of map out where we're going. We walked into a school, and the principal of the school, who is also the chairman of the local precinct commission, invites us to tea, which, of course, you have to sit down for a few minutes. And she wants to show us a video. She puts the video on. The video is school children getting an award for, I think it was Scholastic Achievement. It was a whole big production, 7, 8, 10-minute video. But in the back was a huge red, white, and blue banner for Yedinaya Rossiya, which is Putin's political party. So imagine, you know, going to your elementary school and seeing something sponsored by the Maryland State Democratic Party or something.
Right. Alan Friedman is our guest joining us in this hour of midday. He's an attorney and consultant based in Annapolis who's observed now 6 elections in Eastern Europe. And most recently in Ukraine, just in May.
I
want to talk more about that election in a moment. But I have this question as far as the press goes in some of these countries. In this country, I don't know if it's still our practice, but it used to be our practice that the day before an election, say a Monday, there would be very little news coverage about the candidates themselves, that all the reporting about the candidates had been done up until Sunday, endorsements had been published, and Monday was supposed to be sort of a quiet day where you just reported on preparations for voting, something bland like that. Anyway, I think that's true. Yeah. Today we have a story in The Sun about preparations for voting. Yeah.
Voters get ready to go to the polls.
Yeah, and where the candidates spent the last day, without getting into the politics, the different issues, the ideology. So anything like that in Eastern Europe?
Well, one of the sort of interesting aspects in almost all these countries, they shut down electioneering anywhere from 28 to 48 hours before election day starts.
Well, that's not the press. That's like campaigning.
Everything, yeah.
So you can't campaign for...
They don't campaign. There's no rallies. It just is quiet.
Wait a minute. I'm trying to picture this. Can you imagine in this country, election is Tuesday, Monday and Sunday, no campaigning.
No campaigning.
And that actually is done in multiple countries?
And it's a practice that I've seen frequently that it goes quiet for 24 hours usually. Elections are on Sunday in these countries. So,
That so it kind of changes. Friday and Saturday, you get a break.
Sometimes 2 days, sometimes 1 day, but it basically quiets the situation down. And of course, in this most recent election in Ukraine, the situation was extremely problematic, even though, right up to election day, OSCE reported on some very serious violence on election day in the areas under control of the separatists. And on the news, while we were in country, you saw armed men with the ski masks going to the polling places which were being set up in Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts and just pulling the ballot boxes out in the streets, smashing them with their guns. There was great difficulty in getting people to serve on the election, the precinct commissions in these areas. And basically, you disenfranchised a large percentage of people in those regions because of the political violence.
So the regions we're talking about would be on the eastern side?
Southeastern part of
Ukraine.
Bordering with Russia.
Yeah.
I was about 10 or 15 kilometers from the Russian border, but north of this area. OSCE did not send any civilians into the areas that were... Basically dangerous or subject to armed conflict.
And again, when Alan Friedman refers to the OSCE, that's the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, you said they had about 1,000 observers in Ukraine?
They had a total of about 1,000 observers. They also had a military mission, a military observation mission. Part of OSCE also is the treaty, the nations who are part of that treaty agree to allow observation of their military activities. And so as part of the political situation in the southeast, OSCE had sent in military observers, and those are the people who were taken hostage. And in fact, I think 8 are still being held hostage by the separatists.
Had you ever been in an election or observed an election, Alan, where, violence had prevented citizens from voting?
This is the first election where, on such a large scale, it was clear that... international observers were not going to be able to get to the country, into that part of the country. People were not going to be able to vote in that part of the country. In Georgia, there were some difficulties even in those days in the areas which were subject to the conflict in 2008, South Ossetia, which is in the northern part of Georgia, and Abkhazia, which is on the western coast. There were problems. There was sporadic violence, but nothing on the levels that were going on in Ukraine.
So how did they decide that this is a valid election, that Petro Poroshenko is the legitimate new president of Ukraine?
Well, basically, the OSCE, as well as a number of other international organizations that observe the election, NATO has a parliamentary assembly that sends observers, a number of different international treaty groups that send observers. They take all the observations. They take the pre-election observations of whether the campaign was conducted fairly. Was there a level playing field? What do the election laws look like? Do the election laws promote a free and fair election? The concept from the treaty is that an election should express the free and open will of the population, freely and openly expressed. And so with that general concept, the particulars are, what do the election laws look like, for example? Are they fair, evenly based? Does everybody get a fair shot? Are women allowed to vote freely? One of the negative comments in the OSCE report was a lot of polls were very difficult to get to if you were disabled. Hmm. And I noticed that in some of the polls that I saw. So it's an observation that OSCE makes. It makes a recommendation to the host country that maybe this is something you want to look at.
In Ukraine, the physical act of voting is similar to here, or what's the machinery? Are they computerized at all?
Well, number one, it's paper ballots.
It's still paper ballots.
Paper ballots. Yeah. Which...
And have you seen that in all the countries
yes.
you observed?
Yes.
Still paper ballots.
In the Russian election, they had electronic machines. I did not see them. They were not in any of the precincts that I went to. But there were some sort of pilot program to use electronic voting machines. You got to realize, of course, Russia is such a huge place, but they're still using paper ballots, which makes life interesting at 8 o'clock when the polls close and you dump 2,000 or 3,000 pieces of paper out on a table and start counting them by hand.
It's the way it used to be done here years ago, right? I saw a photograph from Ukraine from the elections. I don't know where this was, Alan, but it showed people walking up with a folded paper ballot and dropping them in, looked like a glass clear box.
The box is glass so that all the observers can see what's inside. At 5 minutes before 8, when the polling place opens, we international observers and the local observers are allowed into the polling place under the law, and that's one of the things OSCE looks at. Does the national election law allow accredited observers in before the poll is open to watch the preparation? Are the ballot boxes sealed properly?
Mm-hmm.
Each of the ballot boxes has a piece of paper in it, which is signed by all the members of the precinct commission at 5 of 8. That piece of paper is folded up and dropped in each one of the ballot boxes. At the end of the night, you have to find that piece of paper to ensure that that's the box that you started with.
Wow. Alan Friedman, our guest in this hour of midday, we're talking about the most recent election that he observed for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and that is the one in Ukraine in May, late May. It seems like a long, long time ago, but it was only a few weeks ago.
It was only a few weeks ago.
And this chocolate tycoon, Petro Poroshenko, was elected.
Willy Wonka, as they call him.
Is that what they call him there? Let's take another call about the election here in Maryland today, elections in general, campaigns. John's in Charles Village. Thanks for calling, John.
Yeah, hi. I just had a comment about low voter turnout in Baltimore and Maryland specifically. And, you know, I think part of the problem is that we have no lower limits for the number of people who can vote in order for a vote to be deemed legitimate. So in Baltimore City, for instance, there's like a 20% voter turnout, I believe, and that's registered voters. That amounts to about, let's say, 40-45% of the population of Baltimore or Maryland. So you've got a very, very small number of people who are actually making a voting decision. And so as a practical matter, if you're an incumbent, what you do is you target the folks that have voted repeatedly in the past. And so it's a system that's designed to encourage only targeting folks that have voted and not folks that are going to vote.
All right. It's interesting. I was what Alan was to your point earlier about why we get so much direct mail or why the robocalls come to certain phone numbers. Right.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you do about that?
Well, in this election in Ukraine and in other elections that I've observed, particularly for president, there's a requirement that the winning candidate receive 50% or there's a runoff. So there's at least sort of that kind of requirement in the law that at least you get a majority of the vote first time out or else you have to go through it again. The elections that I see, primarily because of the economics of it, you don't see a lot of mailings. You don't see bumper stickers. Driving down here, I thought, gee, what a great thing. You know, one of these election consultants should go over to some of these countries and start with people standing on the side of the road waving at rush hour or or putting bumper stickers on cars.
Right.
You see in the capital, I saw in Kiev and also in Moscow, and I was in Kazan for the Russian election. You'll see on the street corner kiosks or tents from the political parties, which will have literature and have people handing out literature to the pedestrians going to work or, you know, just passing by on the sidewalk. But I've not seen things like mailers or certainly robocalls.
Alan, do the countries that you visited have what constitutes primaries like we have today, a party primary, or is it just one-step election?
It's primarily one step. For this election in Ukraine for president, you could actually file. You had to pay I think the equivalent was close to $200,000 as a deposit to become a candidate. Along with a number of other requirements, they did have a candidate who registered as Darth Vader, who was campaigning in a full Star Wars outfit. They did disqualify him for failure to pay.
He was representing Putin, the evil empire, or something?
I'm not sure. He had a...
Oh, wait a minute. $200,000. You have to put up... Imagine in this country what an uproar you'd have if you had a entry fee like that. I mean...
You know, you have to have some qualification. Most of these are paid by the political parties.
Okay.
There's also
Do you know what that money is used for? Is it used to run the election?
No, it's paid to the Central Election Commission. So I assume it helps defray the cost of elections.
Okay.
They don't have campaign finance restrictions as such. The individual candidates can put as much money as they want into this. Haven't seen some of the Supreme Court decisions we have as far as campaign financing. Ukraine does have, in this past election, a limit on individual contributions. But as a practical matter, it really boils down, as it does here in the United States, to people who can either self-finance or who have access to significant sources of funds.
It must have been, I don't know if the word is thrilling or inspiring, maybe, for you, to see people in a country that has, started to rip apart. I mean, we had this civil unrest in Ukraine, in Crimea. We had Putin and the big boots and these guys with ski masks and guns, a real maelstrom, you know. And in the midst of this, there's an election. And you fly in there and, I mean, really. Yeah. And for people to go to the polls in the midst of all that, and for the election to... the effort to make a legitimate election in the midst of that. Of course, there was a vote in Crimea, too, but, I mean, in Ukraine.
I think the Ukrainians, my sense was that they wanted to show in this election that this election was monitored internationally, that it was conducted in accordance with an election law, as opposed to the referendum in Crimea, which most international organizations deemed was not a legitimate election. So this was important for them as a country. I had one Ukrainian say to me, every vote is a slap in Putin's face. These are very proud people. My translator, each two-member team has a translator and a driver that takes you around to the various polling places and to the district election offices. He was probably in his late 20s, and his concern was that he was going to get drafted and have to shoot at somebody or be shot. And so he was very, very interested.
He was concerned about war.
He was concerned, personally, he on was a very one-on-one level.
Right. He was concerned about being in the Ukraine army.
It was up close and personal for him.
Yeah.
That this election clarified the political situation in the country, that it elect a person who was going to take charge and try to solve the problem. Because he just did not want to have to shoot his countrymen or be shot at.
Well, now we see an interesting story, a couple of interesting stories today in Ukraine that are worth talking about. One is, I just caught this before we got on the air, that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, is asking for the revocation, this is the Washington Post, the revocation of a parliamentary authorization that gave him the power to invade Ukraine. That's very interesting for Putin. Is actually he's sort of arresting himself. He's pulling himself back, and he's trying to slow things down, lower the temperature.
It seems so. I think, personal opinion, I'm not sure he was ever going to actually invade Ukraine.
Yeah.
So much of this, and we're not used to it, is this massive propaganda war. In Ukraine, the Ukrainians stopped two Russian television stations from being broadcast, allegedly on the basis of it was propaganda. OSCE commented on that probably really isn't the best thing to do, to just shut off channels. And of course, in Crimea, the Crimean authorities, whatever you want to call them, shut off Ukrainian television. So it really became a propaganda war and a war for people's heads as to what was really going on. I saw a video of what appeared to be a schoolroom. And all the school kids had the blue and yellow Ukrainian colors on, standing up yelling, "Hang the Russians, hang the Russians, hang the Russians." And I said to the people as we were watching this, you have no idea where that was produced.
Right.
You know, that could have been produced in Moscow with Russian school children dressed
as
Ukrainian.
The source of it, yeah.
It was crazy.
So in this country, in the United States, we have network television that's owned by corporations, right? We have we don't really have state television. We have public TV, I guess. We have,
and that's the difference. Yeah,
local cable, but we don't have what you're talking about.
It's a tradition, stemming, of course, from the Soviet Union times in terms of the media and how the media was manipulated and used for political reasons. And of course, that's not anything near our tradition.
Interesting. Alan Friedman is with us, visiting from Annapolis today, where he's an attorney and a consultant, a longtime public servant in Maryland, who has served as an observer of six elections in Eastern Europe, most recently the one in Ukraine in May. We'll take a short break here and come back. Open phone lines in this hour if you've been out to vote, or you haven't been out to vote, or you're a grumbling independent wishing you could take part in Maryland's primaries today. 410-662-8780. If you want to talk about it, why the low turnout for this June primary in Maryland, we'll take your phone call after this short break. We also have an email address if you'd like to send us a comment or question, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on Election Day 2014. It's the primary election in Maryland. 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join us with an observation about the Maryland elections. Alan Friedman giving us, sharing his observations about European elections, Eastern European elections specifically. And he was there under the auspices of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Have you, each time you've gone out to observe an election, Alan, has it always been under the OSCE auspices?
Yes.
Now, so a couple of years ago, I got called to Little Italy in Baltimore. Dan, you got to come down here. These Italian guys are here. What's the news in that? Now, these are guys from Big Italy who were members of the – one was a member of the Parliament of Italy, and he had two other fellows with him who were government officials in Italy. And they were part of the OSCE delegation to Maryland to observe our elections. And I thought, well, this is pretty cool. So Europeans are coming to Baltimore to observe our elections. So I go down there to Little Italy, and there's a polling place in St. Leo's Roman Catholic Church. Right. St. Leo the Great. And I observed the observers observing the election. And I was curious what their observations were about our election. And the main observer stepped out of this polling place and looked up and saw the statue of St. Leo. And he saw the crucifix up there. And he said, "This is a church." He says, "Mamma mia." You know, he says, you're having an election, a government election, a government-run election in a religious institute in a church, and he thought that was completely a violation of separation church and state. Has that? I don't even know if this concept comes up in Eastern Europe.
Most of the polling places are schools, or government buildings, as they are here.
Yeah, that's unusual in Little Italy. They have a church, I think,
and maybe more the exception rather than the rule. I think probably locally.
Oh yeah,
sometimes if schools are in session on election day, especially on primary days, they have to find sort of alternatives. So, and then Little Italy is Little Italy. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was interesting. He also had an observation about our voting machines and the way they were angled in the church hall. He felt that, I can't remember the observer's name, but he was a member of Parliament in Italy. He felt that the machines were angled in a certain way that anybody could look over your shoulder and see who you were voting for.
There's a great deal of paranoia. In the countries where I've been, Russia instituted web cameras at the polling places and created a web record so that you could go online in any polling place in the Russian Federation during the election for president. You could watch real time the poll. People were crazy about that because they thought it was all designed to see how
they were voting.
I heard stories of
a little creepy, Alan.
There's invisible ink that depends because it's a paper ballot that you mark with a pen, and the pen is in the little polling where you vote, little stall, that the pens had invisible ink, and that no matter how you voted at the end of the day, certain people are going to come in and mark the ballot because the ink disappeared. So you get a lot of paranoia.
Is that left over from the Soviet state, you think, that paranoia, or is that just human nature?
There's probably a little bit of it here in the United States, too. So,
What did you think generally about voters' fraud, voter security? And let's go to Ukraine, since you were just there recently. For instance, how do they verify that you've only voted once? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, first of all, they require a photo ID, which You know, we can debate that for many hours.
Big
on
issue
the
in the big United
issue
States.
In the United States. Yeah. But one of the things we're asked to observe is, does each voter have to show a photo ID in order to get a ballot? And they don't have the purple ink that you've seen in some of the Middle Eastern elections. There is a voter list that each of the precincts gets from the Central Election Authority. That's sort of the MVA list or your social services list, everything put mm-hmm. together. And if you're on that list, you get to vote. If you're not on that list, you don't get to vote. And so one of the things we're doing in observing is to make sure that we can watch as the person comes up to the table, that they show an ID, that their name is found on the book that they sign, and that they're then issued a ballot and they sign a counterfoil, which is then preserved. So there's, you know, several million of these little slips of paper in a warehouse.
And in Ukraine, a person is registered to vote in a certain, what constitutes a precinct of
yes,
some kind.
Yes.
So you can't just drive someplace, fly somewhere in Ukraine and vote anywhere you like.
No. In the Russian election, the parliamentary election that I observed, they did have, I guess it's sort of the equivalent of our provisional ballot, which a lot of the sort of NGOs in Russia thought was a highly questionable practice because it just meant there were, much as it was questioned here in the United States, of having people voting not where they lived and, you know, what potential fraud that might engender.
What do you think of voting on Sunday based on your experiences in Eastern Europe?
It seems to work there.
Why are we stuck with Tuesdays again? Do we know?
And, of course, many of these countries are extremely religious.
Yeah.
Certainly Ukraine, Russia, Georgia, all very religious countries don't seem to have a problem with voting on Sunday.
Okay. Let me read a couple of emails here. One is from Matt. He says, I took advantage of early voting last week, which is still fairly new in Maryland. My wife left half an hour early for work this morning to stop and vote. I'm sorry. We always try to bring our daughters to vote with us so that they are exposed to the process and importance of voting. Is there any evidence that supports bringing children to the polls results in having them grow into adults who vote? I know it's a good question.
We need a sociologist to track the child to see whether...
I don't know. I bet you someone got a grant to study that at some point, don't you?
Somewhere. I saw that a lot in the elections I observed overseas, where the children come and the children go in the polling place, and then the parent will hand the paper ballot to the child, and the child will put it in.
Hmm.
So it's kind of a similar sort of...
I think it's
theory.
A good thing to do. I don't know if the payoff is that when they become 18, they start voting.
It's a hard thing to track, but like you say, there's probably some government survey somewhere.
Alan, here's an email from Dorothy. When I lived in Canada, there was no campaigning allowed during the week before the election.
A whole week.
Can you imagine? Anyway, that included no ads on TV, radio, or in newspapers. Someone would take this to the Supreme Court and argue violation of the First Amendment.
Free speech.
Right. The time was set aside for the voters to consider what had been said and to decide who to vote for. So a thinking period.
Amazing. Did you take a moment to think about what you're doing?
I kind of like this idea. Earlier this year, I was in Ecuador during their election. Not only was there no campaigning the day before the election, all campaign posters were expected to be torn down. Oh, yeah. Have you seen the campaign posters this year?
It is a blight on scenery.
They're all over the median strips. I've got a photograph posted to my Facebook page that shows a voting place in Silver Spring. I think the Silver Spring Civic Center, maybe? Look at that photograph.
Well, you see some of the street corners, and there's signs for every candidate for an office. You know, people running against each other have signs next to each other on somebody's property.
Alan Friedman has been to Eastern Europe, you said, six times now.
Well, twice when I lived in Georgia, and then four. This was my fourth election since I wasn't living there.
So can you make some comment for us maybe about how things are going to play out in Ukraine? I mentioned the news today about Putin saying, you know, he doesn't want this parliamentary authority to invade if he has to, right? So he's looking like a nice guy now, like he's pulling back. And this other story from the Wall Street Journal says separatist leaders in Ukraine have agreed to join a government-declared ceasefire as a first step toward peace talks. So that sounds good, too.
Well, when you put one and one together, of course, you know, the allegation is these separatists are being financed and armed either directly or indirectly through some Russian authority. I wonder, you can't get a ski mask in Ukraine. They're just there's no ski masks left in any of the stores. You know, John Oliver said, where do you get a tank? Do you go to like a tank store and say, I need four tanks?
Right.
And they just show up on the road. It looks encouraging. It's a very, very difficult situation. Poroshenko has a mandate, and that's, I think, a lot of people wanted to give him that mandate. He took off militarily the day after the election against the separatists who had taken over Donetsk airport with a very significant military presence. And so I think people were saying, you know, his comment to the press was, I can't deal with Somali pirates. These people are Somali pirates. Hmm. And until the rhetoric got toned down, both from Moscow and from Kiev, and the military situation got turned down, it was really going to be a bad situation. But it seems like things are...
Yeah, I mean, it was looking pretty grim there even a month ago. And you were there for the election, and there was still violence.
It was extremely disturbing. And you had a sense that this country could go apart any minute.
Yeah.
With tremendous levels of violence.
We should also mention the pressure on Putin, some of it inflicted by our own president here. I mean, this is a considerable thing. He cannot remain isolated, especially with the economics.
He's got two sides of an operation to deal with. He's got a lot of nationalists in Russia who believe that the separatists should be supported militarily and financially, and that Ukraine is actually historically part of Russia. Mm-hmm. And the Kievan Rus is, I mean, these people are ethnically Russian, and they ought to be protected, quote unquote. And yet he's got also his businessmen associates who are making a lot of money, who need Western banks, who need the Western financial systems, who have contracts with Western governments. They've got a multi-million dollar, billion dollar contract with France for these military, not quite aircraft carriers, but they're significant pieces of military hardware, and I think people are telling him, look, you know, you've got to settle this down or the West is going to be forced to really step up the sanctions.
It's kind of amazing when you think about it, that Ukraine staging this election in the midst of all this, a real storm,
and
compare it, think what might have happened 15 years ago. I mean, you started observing elections in 99 over there. Imagine 15 years ago, a colder period, albeit the Cold War was over, but albeit it would have been colder than now. It could have been a lot worse.
Well, people go in the streets. I walked through Maidan. I'd been there 20 months before.
Maidan in Ukraine.
In Ukraine, in Kiev, the capital city, which is a central city. There's shopping centers. There's hotels. It's a metro stop. Any central city in Europe was fine. 20 months later, it's destroyed. There's burned out buildings. There's barricades. There's still people who are occupying the area because it's a memorial now. 100 people were shot dead in the capital of a European country,
yeah.
And in 2014. So it's kind of sobering when you walk through that and you see the little memorials and the candles, you know, very, very Orthodox little memorials. Every place somebody was shot, you see a little stand of candles.
And yet people went out to vote in May at that election in Ukraine. And here we are in Maryland talking about such a low voter turnout, lack of interest in this election today. Maybe things will pick up this afternoon. I don't know. It's election day, folks. You might think about it. The primary, up until 8 o'clock tonight, you can vote. Alan Friedman has been our guest, a longtime public servant in Maryland, Annapolis attorney and consultant who has 6 times observed elections in Eastern Europe under the auspices of the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe. Most recently was there in May to observe the elections in Ukraine, sharing his experiences with us. Thank you, Alan. It's very interesting. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure. Always good to see you, Dan.
Yep. And thank you, folks, for tuning in. That's our first hour. We're going to take a break for lunch on Tuesday, brought to us by Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building over in Harbor East. Thank you very much for lunch for our guests and sometimes our staff. We'll see you for the second hour of Midday and Ralph Nader after the news.